Oh, kia ora koutou katoa, and welcome back to this resumed hearing. And the schedule has been circulated, and we have today Mr. Jessen for the council submissions and three witnesses on Zoom. Just some housekeeping matters so that we keep on track in terms of materials. Outstanding is a communication from Ms. Tancock in relation to the references in the High Court decision about the Basin Bridge decision that relate to the so-called chicken and egg topic, based on the proposition that that affirmed a view in the decision of the Board of Inquiry about the assessment of effects. I also note that I have received by email some questions of council officers that Ms. O'Reilly asked me to put. One is to Ms. Lindsay, the social impact analyst or peer reviewer for the council, and the other is to Ms. Fraser. So we'll, those questions are okay, and I'll put those. I had indicated our last hearing a desire for some slightly better knowledge of the worst-case scenario modelling for noise and what level of development that would require in terms of the site to get a sense of when in time it's likely that that level of worst-case scenario would be implemented. And Mr. Jessen has circulated, thankfully, hyperlinked submissions that should be with the panel alongside some other materials, including some joint witness statements, some summaries and proposed conditions. So, commissioners, if you don't have that, perhaps email Ms. Oliver and we'll make sure you have those items, because I suspect we'll be looking at those today. And other than that, I hand it over to Mr. Jessen. Thank you.
You just caught me while I'm cleaning my glasses. Just on the information that's been filed, it includes three summary statements. That's for the reporting officer witnesses who we hope to get through today. Whether we have time for that is another matter. Just on housekeeping, Ms. Lindsay is available today but not tomorrow, so if we can't get to her, then she will be available on Friday morning, which I understand is available as a backup day should we need it. The other thing to note about the materials filed is that we've circulated what we're calling a working set of the council's conditions. And the reason that we're calling it that is because we're very mindful of overloading the panel with formally filed evolving sets of conditions. Ms. Copplestone's intention is to keep working on that as she listens to the discussions we're going to have over the next day or so, and then introduce a end-of-hearing set when she appears. But at the same time, our witnesses need something to be able to speak to if there are any questions about where we currently are with conditions. So that's why we've called it a working set. But ultimately, the intention is to replace it with an end-of-hearing set that will be the last we want to say about conditions.
Thank you. Makes sense.
Now, there's nothing else in terms of housekeeping for me. I think I'd just like to express that our team's very grateful for the final opportunity to get here and to find a way to close this hearing. So thank you to Kath and to the commissioners and everybody for helping us find some time to get through this. Now, I've prepared some written submissions and I think I'll just read them out, if that's all right with you, sir.
Thank you.
A good place to start is paragraph 1, which is after the contents page. May it please the hearing panel. These submissions are provided to assist the panel with the legal framework surrounding the issues identified by the parties to this hearing. We are privileged to have a knowledgeable panel which has demonstrated over the course of the hearing that it has identified the key issues in question. Therefore, and as requested, these submissions focus on the remaining areas of tension. The Freight Hub project is significant in multiple ways, and it is worth acknowledging these areas of significance. It is a major piece of infrastructure providing strategic support to shipping and logistics at a national, regional, and local level. It represents a sizeable investment in the national rail system, the region, and again, the Palmerston North City at a local level. It demonstrates the national strategic vision for the move to rail, the local strategic vision to establish Palmerston North as a distribution hub, and for the whole Lower North Island. And it is also expected to generate significant positive economic effects, again, on those three levels, local, regional, and national. KiwiRail's requirement recognises that the freight hub will change the local community and affect its neighbours. KiwiRail submits that its notice of requirement is supported by a comprehensive effects management package which appropriately addresses its actual and potential adverse effects. However, accurate identification, classification and assessment of the scale and significance of potential effects of allowing the requirement has been a key issue for the reporting officers, and there are topics where there are remaining information gaps, as the planning for the requirement has only developed to the concept design stage and regional council consents are not sought concurrently. This is what KiwiRail describes as its flexible approach, where effects will be confirmed and addressed at a later stage. While this approach is not unusual in the designation process, it is not the standard either. And the approach has led to challenges understanding the degree of certainty that is attributable to the concept design and what might arise from its implementation in terms of potential variances to that. Apart from accurate assessment of effects being a fundamental requirement for robust decision making, uncertainty regarding aspects of the project and its adverse effects draws into question the reliance that can be placed on the outline plan process for effects management. The reporting officers consider that if the designation is confirmed, it should incorporate clear framing of the project through its conditions to ensure that the project will be developed in accordance with KiwiRail's desire to create an envelope of effects as opposed to a sieve. The separation of this requirement process from regional consent processes has been another challenge for the reporting officers. The officers are aware of the issues of overlapping regional and territorial jurisdictions. However, the approach taken by KiwiRail of lodging its requirement and waiting until after its designation is confirmed to apply for regional consents adds to the uncertainty described above as to the effective management of the freight hub's effects. This sequential approach also, in the reporting officer's view, makes achieving integrated management all the more challenging and complex, including the development of appropriately targeted conditions. It is appropriate to also recognise that uncertainty has shaped aspects of the reporting officer's reports and in many cases has been iteratively made more certain over time through this process and the various revisions of conditions. And I note that KiwiRail has put forward to date, I think, 5 versions of conditions, including in response to information requests put by the officers. The reporting officers will offer the panel an end-of-hearing set of conditions which, in their opinion, are appropriate conditions to recommend to KiwiRail, subject, of course, to the panel applying its own collective knowledge and experience to the exercise while making its recommendations. The reporting officers do not profess to have achieved perfection in their attempt to make sense of and work through conditions, but have certainly carefully thought through the issues and are willing to continue to provide any requested assistance. Finally, the Council's team are extremely grateful for the opportunity to hear from KiwiRail's team and all the submitters who have appeared over this hearing, in particular those most affected by the requirement. They hope that the officers' reports and summaries to the panel demonstrate that the officers do not take these submissions lightly. In the next section, sir, I'm just telling you who the reporting officers are and what reports you should have. So I'm assuming I can skip past that section.
Sure.
At 1.3, I'm just letting you know how I'm going to break things down today. The next section, regrettably, is a rather dense section that perhaps will be of limited interest to many in the room because it addresses quite a narrow and legalistic issue regarding the jurisdiction issues that you've heard about already. Sorry, just a bit of feedback. Part three, so following jurisdiction, I'm going to address the panel on some of the aspects of section 171. And in that section, I'm going to try and provide a helpful framework and try and distill some of the principles that I think will be relevant for the panel when it carries out its evaluation. And the last section of the submission is just going to address the miscellany of other legal issues that have cropped up throughout. I don't say that I've addressed everything, but then again, I don't think you need to have everything addressed, and I'm happy to talk through any issues that you think I might have missed along the way and you want further guidance on. So turning to the... I should also say that my colleague to my right is... Alex Sinclair, he's in my team, and he's offered, and I've gratefully accepted his offer, to help me out in reading through these submissions, and he's going to talk to you about the assessment of alternative section when we come to it. Cool. So on to jurisdiction. I hope you've got your coffees handy. Jurisdictional issues have been raised by some submitters. Ms. Tancock, counsel for Drs. Whittle and Fox, filed a memorandum with this panel, dated 8 July 2021, identifying concerns as to the extent of KiwiRail's ministerial approval as a requiring authority, which she expanded on in her oral submissions. Those submissions consider the language of the minister's approval of KiwiRail as a requiring authority and promotes a narrow interpretation of that approval. Submitting that in the light of that approval, there appears to be no lawful basis in the Gazette notice or the RMA to allow for the wide range of activities proposed within the freight hub. The Gazette notice in question reads, KiwiRail Holdings Limited is hereby approved as a requiring authority under Section 167 of the RMA for its network utility operation, being the construction, operation, maintenance, replacement, upgrading, improvement and extension of its railway line. KiwiRail, in its legal submissions dated 6 August, submits that the freight hub is clearly within the scope of KiwiRail's powers as a requiring authority to designate land for the operation of its railway line. For further statutory context, the Act permits a requiring authority for the purposes of its approved network utility operation to issue a notice of requirement for land, both for a project work and where a restriction is reasonably necessary for the safe or efficient functioning or operation of such a project or work. As such, the jurisdictional issue for the panel to determine appears to be whether the full range of activities proposed to occur in the freight hub can be considered within the scope of the operation of KiwiRail's railway line in accordance with the Gazette notice, and or reasonably necessary for the safe or efficient functioning or operation of that line. As a preliminary matter, it appears the panel has the jurisdiction to make such a determination. All I'm saying in that paragraph, sir, is there's authority in Malvern Hills in which Justice Smith, as I recall it, was addressing these jurisdictional issues and indicated that that's a matter for a panel in the first instance to grapple with.
Yeah, I have no difficulty with that proposition. I think it's standard in administrative law that if a question goes to your jurisdiction as an ancillary matter, you have to address it. But just in relation to your last sentence, paragraph 20, actually one sentence, the words reasonably necessary for the safe or efficient functioning of the operation, my recollection is when I looked at those words that related to a designation that operated as a restriction as opposed to enabling. So a designation can actually restrict other uses.
Yes.
And that's so correct, because that isn't what we're dealing with here, the test is simply whether it's within a approved requiring a requiring authority's approved scope of designation.
Yes, that's fair, sir. I don't think anything particularly turns on that second point. So I'm just going to delve into some interpretation issues now. Ms. Tancock submitted originally, it's in her first memorandum, that the appropriate definition of railway line to be used is from the Railways Act. That definition is fairly literal in our submission, stating that railway line means single rail or set of rails having a gauge of 550 millimetres or greater between them, laid for the purposes of transporting people or goods by rail, including associated sleepers, ballast tunnels, bridges, and up to 5 metres land from the centre of the rail line. So quite narrow. Ms. Tancock submits that that definition of railway line or similar should be preferred when interpreting the Gazette notice, as in her submission, the Railways Act 2005 and the RMA are interfacing pieces of legislation. Quite what is meant by interfacing has not been further explained. Submitting at the hearing, Ms. Tancock expanded on her preferred interpretation, stating that it is supported by the ministerial reasoning leading to the requiring authority approval for the New Zealand Railway Corporation. This is the one that preceded the approval for KiwiRail specifically, and by the fact that it would be on what an ordinary, reasonable member of the public would interpret the Gazette notice as meaning. So I just want to address those points. But first, KiwiRail, in its legal submissions, highlights that the RMA does not define railway line or refer to the Railways Act definition or the New Zealand Railways Corp definition in force at the time of its enactment. Despite this, the definition of network utility operator expressly incorporates the term railway line, suggesting in KiwiRail's submission that Parliament did not intend to limit the scope of railway line by adopting that specific definition or incorporating that specific definition. Further, as KiwiRail notes, the Minister chose not to incorporate a direct reference to a definition of railway line in the Gazette notice. Council's view aligns with KiwiRail on this point. First, it's not obvious why the question of what an ordinary, reasonable member of the public would think should apply to interpretation of the Gazette notice. This is not a designation, even if it may lead to one.
Well, the point on that is that a lot of the commentary on what it might mean looks backwards on people's experience of what a railway line looks like.
Yes.
But the Interpretation Act says that we must look at it and address it as the circumstances arise.
That's correct.
So the problem with a retrospective lens is that you potentially are not giving due regard to a purposive approach.
I agree with that submission, sir.
Yeah.
Um, I was about halfway through para 26.
Yes, sorry.
No, that's okay, sir. I'm happy for interruptions. It's a problem when you have a script in front of you, though, sir.
Yeah.
Nor does the Gazette notice necessarily serve to the function of notifying the public of the scope of authority provided to the requiring authority. By virtue of being the body providing recommendations under Section 171, the primary user of the Gazette notice, besides the requiring authority, is likely the relevant territorial authority. The second point is that the Gazette notice provides KiwiRail the power to designate for a broad range of purposes related to its railway line, including its operation, maintenance, upgrading and improvement. The ministerial approval for this broad range of purposes indicates against the strict application of a narrow definition of railway line, such as the definition from the Act. In the absence of any other indication that it should apply, it is unlikely to have been the intention of the Minister in granting KiwiRail approval to designate for the purpose of providing for its railway line operations that KiwiRail should not be able to continue to provide for those operations as the demands on a modern railway operator changed over time.
Mm.
However, if the Act, Railways Act definition does not apply, then what definition does? On its face, a railway line extends at least to wherever tracks extend, capturing much of the proposed designation extent. And the question is, what other range of activities, if any, should be included in that term? On this point, KiwiRail highlights that its application for requiring authority status detailed a broad range of activities that it considered to fall within the construction and operation of its railway line, including providing for track slew and realignments, maintenance and upgrading to provide facilities for modal transfer. That includes yards and sidings. On one hand, the Minister's decision to grant a network utility operator's application for requiring authority status is not restricted or expanded by the scope of that application, but the Minister may grant requiring authority status on whatever terms it sees fit. Equally, however, Council does not support Ms. Tancock's submissions that the application material is completely irrelevant to interpreting the Gazette notice. The Minister's consideration of whether and how to grant requiring authority status must, to some extent, have been guided by what was applied for. The application, while not determinative, may be able to act as an extrinsic interpretation aid to the Gazette notice where there's ambiguity. Here, in the context of an expansive description of the activities KiwiRail supplied to justify its application for requiring authority status, the Minister's approval in the notice is expressed in reasonably unrestricted terms in our submission. The lack of terms and conditions expressly restricting KiwiRail's requiring authority status, even after the application put the Minister on notice of all the things that KiwiRail considered relevant to its operations, could suggest that the Minister did not intend to constrain the requiring authority powers to exclude those activities. It also noted that a narrow and literalist interpretation of railway line, sorry, it is also noted that a narrow interpretation of railway line would only allow KiwiRail to designate land under or directly adjacent to its actual tracks. This poses a particular problem in the context of the RMA, as such a narrow designation extent would leave insufficient area for works to mitigate the effects of the primary works, a conclusion likely to be inconsistent with the Act's sustainable management purpose. Accordingly, I consider it likely that for the purposes of the RMA and the Gazette notice, that the term railway line means something broader than simply tracks. Further, the wording of the Gazette notice allows for works of the operation of KiwiRail's line, as well as improvement and extension. As KiwiRail highlights, the operation of the line necessarily includes marshalling and transit, loading and unloading of freight. Finally, the Act permits KiwiRail to designate land. This is a point you raised earlier, sir, where you mentioned that this might not necessarily apply here to a project, but in my submission the following points still stand, so I'll work through them. As a range of activities ancillary to railway lines could conceivably fall within KiwiRail's powers of designation, and there is unlikely to be a clear demarcation of activities intra and ultra vires. It would seem sensible then for the panel to adopt a scale and degree approach to the extent of KiwiRail's approval as a requiring authority and determine whether any particular activity in question is sufficiently connected to the central railway line activity.
Yeah, so that's a characterisation approach and basically a factual assessment.
Correct, and it goes back to the discussion we had a short while ago about the Interpretation Act and interpreting in relation to circumstances as they arise.
Yeah, makes sense.
Some activities proposed for the freight hub seem, on first blush, reasonably distant from the literal meaning of railway line, particularly the freight forwarders and distribution centres. However, this is directly the point, sir, terms and enactments apply to circumstances as they arise. Mm. Additionally, the adoption of an ambulatory approach in interpreting the words of grants of authority to undertake public works finds support in relevant case law. And this goes to that case that I think you discussed with Ms. Arthur Young, the Craigie investment case. The freight forwarders and distribution centres are so-called level one users, to borrow CEDA's terminology, as they require a railhead location. In our submission, they appear to be an adjunct to the core facilities of the freight hub. During this hearing, the panel has also heard from experts from KiwiRail that all the activities proposed for the freight hub, including the freight forwarders, are necessary for the effective operation of a modern railway operation. If the panel accepts that evidence, it may be open for the panel to conclude that all the activities proposed for the freight hub fall within KiwiRail's powers of designation.
I was just thinking also a substantial portion of this designation is actually to manage stormwater, which would be an ancillary activity to those. So the tracks argument becomes, for the reason you described, pretty unattractive.
I agree with that, sir. Certainly in our submission it should include those activities that are necessary to mitigate the primary activity.
Mm.
And that would include the stormwater.
Yeah.
And other matters.
Thank you.
I'm turning now to some more sort of fundamental evaluative principles in section page 10. This is section 3 of my submissions.
Mm.
Excuse me. KiwiRail's requirement is advanced by it with the acknowledgement that it includes degrees of flexibility and some uncertainty as to its final form and impact. KiwiRail explains that its requirement allows for a number of features to change at the detailed design stage, and accordingly, it places significant reliance on management plans and the outline plan mechanism to address effects. This section considers the appropriateness of that approach in the context of a designation for a large project and considers the application of relevant principles from case law that may be helpful to the panel's evaluation. As a preliminary point, it is acknowledged that it does not appear. There is a fundamental difference of legal opinion as to the relevant principles here. And in our submission, the differences between KiwiRail's legal position on this and the considerations that I'm going to set out can probably be described as matters of emphasis rather than fundamental difference. For example, KiwiRail invites the panel to rely on the outline plan process as a further opportunity for refinement of the project. The reporting officers do not share KiwiRail's confidence that the outline plans can be a complete solution to appropriately address adverse effects, particularly where there's uncertainty in the technical assessments on various topics about the scale and significance of those adverse effects. Now, talking about information standards and the balance that one needs to find with certainty, designations have been fairly described in this hearing as a unique beast. Forgive me, sir, I think that was your terminology at one stage.
Yeah.
Although they are a standard RMA tool to enable large infrastructure projects, they are designed to be more flexible than more common RMA permissions and processes, such as resource consents. Part 8, it's a designation part, sets out the process for a requiring authority to give notice of its requirement, the evaluative processes, and the effect of the designation. Designations have two primary functions under the RMA. The first is enabling, the second is protecting, or in other words, restricting. The enabling function is commonly described as a spot zoning in a district plan, which enables activities on the relevant land following an outline plan process. The protective or restrictive function of the designation prevents any other development from establishing within a designated area that would be incompatible with the public work. Although the designation process bears some similarities to a resource consent application process, there are some key procedural differences which set it apart and elevate a requiring authority to something that's, in other cases, been described as a privileged position under the RMA. For example, although there's a requirement in Form 18, that's the initiating form for this process, Commissioners, although there's that requirement in Form 18 to describe adverse effects, the effects that the project will have on the environment, compliance with the requirements of Schedule 4 in the RMA is not mandated for an NOR, and that's specifically the requirements for an assessment of environmental effects that you would get with a resource consent application. I don't mean to say that it's not good practice to abide by Schedule 4, but it's just not stipulated as a legal requirement. Secondly, there's no power under there's no power that is analogous to Section 88(3) of the Act to allow a territorial authority to return a notice of requirement that it might consider to be incomplete when it's first lodged. There is also no power to proceed to a hearing, no power not to proceed to a hearing if the territorial authority determines that other resource consents are required. For example, if it determined that regional resource consents was required, there's no option to put the brakes on this process until that follow-up process catches up. Fourth, instead of a decision, here a territorial authority gives recommendations, with the final decision reserved for the requiring authority, and that's a privilege that's not afforded to resource consent applicants. And finally, there's no provision in Section 171 that corresponds to Section 104(6) of the Act that would allow the territorial authority to refuse to confirm a requirement if it finds that it had inadequate information to determine it. Therefore, the statutory scheme makes it possible for requiring authorities to give their requirements in more general terms than what is expected and required for resource consent application. While the trend for responsible requiring authorities is to provide increasing level of details in their requirements, those evaluating a requirement under Section 171, such as the panel here, are obliged to make recommendations on the information available to them. There are policy reasons why requiring authorities are not held to the same standards as resource consent applicants. For instance, requiring authorities, that's authorities which are not ministers of the Crown or local authorities, have already been vetted, in a sense, by the minister under Section 171 as meeting the criteria to be given requiring authority status in the first place. The prospective requiring authority is obliged or must be a network utility operator responsible for significant infrastructure. Their projects have, by their very nature, elements of public good. And furthermore, the minister must be satisfied that the prospective requiring authority will satisfactorily carry out all the responsibilities of a requiring authority under this Act and will give proper regard to the interests of those affected and to the interests of the environment. With that said, good practice still exists in resource management. in respect of assessment of environmental effects, even for notices of requirement, with the expectation of requiring authorities to give proper regard to the interests of those affected and to the interests of the environment. The Board of Inquiry in the Basin Bridge requirement, for example, accepted the relevance of the following principles established in case concerning resource consents. Perhaps I won't read this extract out. This is a well-known and often cited case in the resource consent sphere, which sets out some of the expectations for information and resource consents. And one of those elements is that all consents that are required for a permission are sought at the same time. Now over to paragraph 48. Generally, these good practice principles are critical to the ability of decision makers to reach informed decisions, even if they must be adapted to respond to the scheme of Part 8, for example, where regional council consents are deliberately excluded, as is the case here. Their underlying importance is reinforced in Sustainable Matata versus Bay of Plenty Regional Council, which we submit as a cautionary tale about requirements that aspire for maximum flexibility at the expense of accurate assessment of effects and demonstratively achievable controls through conditions. And in our submission, that case is relevant to understanding of the desirable approach when faced with requirements pitched on the basis that flexibility is required. Now, sir, I'm happy to read through the extract.
I think we've actually had that, and unless my commissioners want to hear that, then I'm happy just to move to the next paragraph.
Sir, you've had selections from it, but I in your own time, sir and commissioners, it might be useful. I've provided a more fulsome quote that I think more accurately captures the commentary in that case about those risks. Another relevant case is the Minister of Corrections in Otorohanga District Council, which highlights the need for accurate effects assessment at the requirement stage while acknowledging the inherent flexibility allowed by the process, then holding that flexible requirements cannot permit activities beyond those that are considered as acceptable at the primary stage of 171 evaluation. The court identifies scope concerns and procedural fairness considerations as reasons why. I will read this one out. Because designations are flexible devices, this necessitates careful attention. This is given to the conditions of the designation and, in particular, to those conditions the purpose of which is to constrain development within the limits and boundaries of effects that are considered acceptable by the expert witnesses and ultimately the court. As noted, few design parameters were proposed in that notice of requirement. The flexibility of the designation process does not extend to enabling adverse effects on the environment that are different in substance or materially greater than those effects assessed by the decision maker and considered subject to Part 2. Whether the effects are different in substance or materially greater is a question of scale and degree. A decision to confirm the designation that is enabling in this way is unfair to persons who did not make a submission. And thirdly, another case, the Board of Inquiry on Transmission Gully has some relevance. Advanced with a familiar flexible approach and an effects management regime that depended on 12 management plans covering effects that were uncertain at that stage, the Board proceeded to consider the approach as a form of adaptive management technique, which it described in this way: a system for managing effects of generally large projects where the nature and extent of those effects is uncertain and the outcome of methods proposed to avoid, remedy or mitigate them is similarly uncertain. Adaptive management regimes are commonly established through conditions of consent, incorporating management plans which seek to manage the effects for any given activity in a flexible and responsive manner. The Board confirmed that the use of that process or that framework can be an appropriate means of managing environmental effects. It went on to say the essential test of any method of managing effects under the Act is whether or not it achieves the purpose of the Act, set out in Section 5. And it said there's no reason why an adaptive management regime cannot achieve that purpose. However, as with other authorities considering flexible approaches, the board explained the trade-off that adopting a flexible approach will require. We also emphasise the importance of conditions of consent if adaptive management regimes are to operate properly. In his advice to the board, Mr. Milne identified the need for conditions to be clear, certain, and enforceable. Conditions need to contain quantifiable standards and performance criteria against which proposed management plans can be assessed and subsequent operation of the management plans measured. The board considered that the conditions proposed by the applicants at the conclusion of the hearing generally achieved those objectives. While appeal of a flexible process for requirement is acknowledged, standards of information that can be expected or required in relation to effects on the environment of allowing a requirement do not differ substantially from those which apply in other situations under the Act. Indeed, the sequencing within Section 171 to consider the effects of the environment of allowing a requirement first speaks to its importance as the source of the assessment from which the evaluation must flow, with matters requiring particular regard falling out of that in subsections A to D. Finally, the consideration of the effects of a proposal on the environment under 171 is, of course, subject to Part 2. The approach of the Basin Bridge to this issue was, prior to considering the matters in Section 171, 1B to D, to consider and evaluate the adverse and beneficial effects on the environment informed by the relevant provisions of Part 2, the relevant statutory instruments, and other relevant matters being the relevant conditions and the relevant non-statutory documents. I didn't realise how many times His Honour said relevant in that passage until now. Paragraph 54, a similar conceptual approach was taken in Queenstown Airport, where Justice Fotter described the framing and cascade of Section 171 in this way. It will be seen that the focal point of the assessment is subject to Part 2, consideration of the effects of allowing the requirement having particular regard to the stated matters. The import of this is that the purpose, policies and directions in Part 2 set the frame for the consideration of the effects on the environment of allowing the requirement. Indeed, in the event of conflict with the directions in 171, Part 2 matters override them. Paramount in this regard is Section 5, dealing with the purpose of the Act, namely to promote sustainable management of natural and physical resources. Assessing whether a proposal fits within the Part 2 frame for the consideration of its effects, to use Justice Fotter's analogy, would be highly challenging without a sufficient level of information to reliably assess those effects. Now, sir and commissioners, from that, I've got a much briefer subsection here in which I try to distill the principles that I've just talked about. In Council's submission, the discussion above can be distilled into a set of principles for the panel to apply when considering this requirement and formulating its recommendations. Those are that the panel must have enough information to be able to understand the scale and significance of the various adverse effects to effectively undertake its tasks under Section 171. Second, while designations are flexible devices, requirements framed to maximise that flexibility call for careful attention to ensure that conditions set boundaries for the proposed activity in ways appropriate to manage its effects. And thirdly, that conditions cannot enable adverse effects that are different in substance or materially greater than those assessed under Section 171 and which have been considered subject to Part 2. To do otherwise would result in unfairness. In our submission, the panel may like to utilise these principles to navigate some of the key issues, key issue areas in this case, where there are identifiable gaps in the information and assessment of effects of allowing the requirement.
I just interpolate there. So the principal topic, as I recall it, where there was an argument about insufficiency of information, was in relation to the visual effects the O'Reillys might experience if they moved to their tenant's house and that became their permanent residence, given that there were no visual, there's no information about visually what the developed site would look like. And how the mitigation would operate. And I think also there were people, I can't recall their names, but they had two boys who had certain medical conditions and they couldn't work out quite how the bunding would impact on their views. The first thing about that is that we have a reasonable appreciation of what activity will do in terms of impacts, visual impacts. We can't quantify those because sometimes visual impacts are difficult to quantify anyway, but we do have from the isthmus consultant for the applicant some general ideas about how those visual impacts can be mitigated by the solutions on Sanctus Road and along the edge where properties sit in Maple Road. And as long as we know what the worst-case scenario is and what, within reasonable bounds, the consequences of mitigation might be, are we really in the position that Mr. Slyfield suggests, that we have inadequate information about the potential scale and character and intensity of effects of this proposal, allowing for the fact that intrinsic to a designation is some degree of flexibility?
Well, sir, the principles I've given to you are on a general level.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to be careful not to tell you exactly where those information deficiencies might be. I would say that the specific information gap areas that you've just talked about are not necessarily all of the areas where the council officers are thinking that there might be, I think deficiencies might be the wrong word, but there's an absence of detail in terms of how some of those issues might develop over time. So I think one of the key points I'm trying to communicate is that where there are some areas where there's not fully developed information that tells the panel conclusively what those effects might be, that is in relation to ecology, natural character, there is some uncertainty with noise. My invitation for the panel is just to look at that in the context of what can be achieved through limits and conditions, and to satisfy itself that it has enough, taking those matters into account.
Okay, well, those principles are actually helpful, thank you. But slightly pushing back on that, it might be useful if Ms. Copplestone fleshes out in her planning evidence where we're reaching the limits of acceptable uncertainty that is not addressed either by the conditions she proposes or the mechanisms within those conditions to reduce those effects, just so that we have a sense of engaging with that directly in fairness to everybody. So that would be helpful anyway.
Thank you, sir. The next section I'm going to talk about is interactions with regional consenting, and the first topic I'm going to jump into is ecology, and then I'm going to talk more briefly about some of the other areas of overlap. And I'm talking about ecology first because it's an interesting but very complicated issue where there is some overlap. And I just wanted to set out and explain the reporting officer's approach to this.
Thanks.
First, some areas of identified uncertainty within the effects of the freight hub are on topics where there are overlapping resource management functions between the territorial and regional authorities. We consider that overlap in terms of ecological considerations are a special case. This section focuses on framing the legal and factual issues concerning evidence of the technical experts and planners in relation to ecological values. We then briefly address other areas of jurisdictional overlap. Excuse me. There are broadly three issues that are not resolved between the reporting officers and KiwiRail in relation to ecological issues. That's on the evidence, sir. First, what is the correct approach to considering these effects? What are the effects of the freight hub on ecological values? And thirdly, how should effects on the above be managed, if at all, at this stage? Relevant to all questions here is that KiwiRail has identified that regional consents will be required for the freight hub, and that those consents will be applied for in due course. That's prior to submitting its outline plan to the council. While it can, as above, be regarded as a matter of good practice to seek necessary regional consents concurrently, this is allowed by the scheme of the Act. KiwiRail submits that in circumstances where regional consents are required but are not concurrently sought, the 171 inquiry is limited in nature to whether the panel can be satisfied that the effects on the environment could sensibly be addressed and concluded at the subsequent stage. We agree with that submission. It is therefore assumed that KiwiRail's technical reports on these issues are to demonstrate that the panel can be satisfied of this inquiry. However, KiwiRail's submissions are a little contradictory about the correct approach to take as well. KiwiRail also discusses its approach of not seeking regional consents at this stage, submitting that effects of those activities that will also require regional consents are not properly considered as effects of allowing this requirement for the purpose of Section 171, and the suggestion is that they do not need to be assessed at all. We disagree with that, if that is what KiwiRail means. While the effects on the ecological and natural character values of any wetlands and rivers and their margins will need to be directly assessed in future 104 processes, the freight hub proposal involves a codependence between this requirement and those other consents. The reality is that the freight hub project cannot proceed in its current form without both allowing the requirement under 171 and allowing the activities under Section 104. There is an inherent risk of missing potentially relevant effects from consideration, and this arises where all required permissions are not sought concurrently. And from excluding effects from consideration in this way would be somewhat artificial in our submission. In this context, KiwiRail's other submission should be preferred. The effects are relevant as a mandatory consideration for the panel, but that the nature of the inquiry into those effects can be limited in nature, allowing a lesser degree of specificity and recognition that future processes will address those effects in a more direct and specific way. Now, you might recall a few minutes ago I was discussing the importance of framing documents under Section 171. Here in relation to the limited assessment of these effects, the most relevant documents to frame the assessment are the One Plan and the NPSFM. The panel is aware in this region... the Regional Council has allocated to itself the responsibility of managing the land use through rules for the purpose of maintaining or enhancing Indigenous biological diversity. This allocation of responsibility is in Policy 6.1 of the Regional Policy Statement, part of the One Plan. And here, Ms Quinn and Ms Copplestone both acknowledge that the Regional Council has the primary role in relation to ecological matters. Despite this, it is nevertheless submitted that the region, that the territorial authority, in this case the panel, does have some role in ecological matters that calls for measured consideration of them. This role derives from the TA's functions under Section 31, the inquiry under Section 171, and both those framing documents I addressed earlier, the One Plan and the MPSFM. And so the following discussion considers what that some role could be by reference to the policy documents. Under the RPS, policy 61C is relevant, as below. It provides that both the regional council and territorial authorities must be responsible for recognising and providing for matters described in section 6C RMA and having particular regard to matters identified in section 7D when exercising functions and powers under the RMA. Outside the specific responsibilities allocated above, including when making decisions on resource consent applications. And Section 7D of the Act requires that those exercising functions and powers to consider the intrinsic value of ecosystems. There is also the NPSFM, which is a more recent and higher level policy document than the One Plan in this case. Despite KiwiRail's submission that the MPSFM is a plan-making policy and that its application is difficult here, I agree with the second point. The Environment Court has held that it must be considered in the evaluation of a notice of requirement, and this is a reference to Judge Dwyer's decision, and I believe that's a Mount Messenger inquiry. Case authority suggests that an evaluation can, at least, be carried out to the level of considering a proposal in respect of the MPSFM's Part 2 objectives and policies. Logically, this must also, in our submission, include defined terms in the, that should say MPSFM, not notice of requirement, to the extent that those definitions are necessary to understand the objectives and policies.
Were both those cases equivalent to this in the sense that the NOR was limited, it didn't have regional consents concurrently running? Those cases didn't, they just said the matters that are relevant anyway.
Yeah, Mount Messenger's the most on point in that regard, yes. Hmm. The second case I've referred to is a wastewater discharge consent. So it was a regional consent application where all matters had been heard and a decision was pending, and then the NPSFM came out. Submissions were called from council as to the relevance of the NPSFM to its assessment, given its late introduction, and the court simply held that it is something that must be considered.
So just so I'm clear about this in my own head, when the statute says the effects of allowing the notice of requirement, have the courts interpreted the phrase allowing the notice of requirement in a way that's not limited to its jurisdictional effect as enabling land use, but that somehow the notice of requirement has a shadow effect on other consequences in the environment?
Not directly to that point, sir, but the complication with ecology effects is that it is also a function of the TA. So there is that functional overlap between
except
the
in relation to in-stream. You mean beyond, not in-stream ecology, you mean other ecology?
Yeah. Yes.
Because I'm just a little bit confused about the MPSFM, because I appreciate that it's not only in-stream ecology, because it's banks and rivers and other things, but yes, it's certainly focused on in-stream ecology.
Mm. Yes, well, guided by the objectives and policies, gives you, I suppose, a flavour of the content of that and its applicability here.
So what's your position then in relation to in-stream ecology effects? Because it seems an unnatural use of language to say by allowing this requirement, which is intrinsically limited to enabling matters within the land use jurisdiction, could lead to effects on in-stream ecology. That seems a very unnatural idea.
I don't know that that's how far we are taking this.
I'm not suggesting you are. I just need some help on it because, for example, your stormwater expert talked about the difficulty of fish navigating a 600-metre stormwater structure, and that's, I would have thought, an in-stream ecology effect.
Yeah. Well, also, sir, I think keeping in mind the frame of this is the question that we're trying to answer is the one that we agree with KiwiRail on, which is their obligation to demonstrate that there's essentially a viable consenting pathway so that it can do everything necessary to implement the NOR.
Yeah, we can't go any further than that, can we, by saying, well, there is a... You mean there aren't any obvious Part 2 matters which would stand in the way of at least considering these options?
Correct, and not so far as they relate strictly to matters over which the Regional Council has reserved control.
Yeah.
But the first point is, of course, the starting point is that is a valid question to ask, is whether there's a viable consenting pathway in the regional council sphere. That is recognised, and then I think you said it's confusing, but it is confusing. This is a very confusing area of the law and decision-making, particularly influenced by the fact that we have an NPS in place with policies and objectives that does indeed throw a cat amongst the pigeons in terms of even the approach specifically in this region about managing biodiversity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I just wonder whether the pathway is possibly Section 171, subsection 1, subparagraph D, which is that it's rational to consider whether matters not strictly governed by the notice of requirement present any major impediments to the appropriateness of that activity. In other words, that reasonably necessary test, it would not be rational to ignore the major impediments that exist under other statutory functions. Is that one pathway to the viability test?
Yes, that is one pathway. The perhaps more direct pathway is that the panel is required to consider relevant provisions of a regional policy statement or proposed policy statement. So that does oblige the panel to look at, to a degree, any relevant provisions of the NPSFM, and that it must look at to answer that question.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm asking these questions, but it is, as you say, a little bit enigmatic.
It is, and I'm trying to express it in a clear way, but it's sort of inherently complicated. But that's it. Yes, I'd say you're obliged to look at those provisions. You must do that. But we're saying that the legitimate purpose of looking at those documents is to answer that question about the... I suppose you'd call them the potential roadblocks down the track.
Mm.
I suppose, to put it in simple terms, a requirement is a considerable, it's been called blight or imposition on a community that's affected by it. And so in simple terms, it doesn't make logical sense to impose a requirement with potentially a very long lapse date and long tail that may subsequently struggle down the road to even get the consents necessary to implement it.
Yeah, and I think that's attractive and comes more to D, which is really a mandate to keep a degree of realism in the assessment.
Yes. Let me just look over the page, sir, and I'll see how much I've covered of that. That's absolutely fine, sir. I'm probably best just to keep reading now. Eventually I'll get to the approach that we are proposing, which might somewhat make all this discussion seem a little bit redundant, but I think it is an important point to cover anyway. So I was at paragraph 71, I think. The MPSFM expressly provides that it has some application now in this context. It commences by directing users to Part 4, which is about the timing and implementation of it, and Part 4 immediately specifies the timing, as every local authority must give effect to this NPS as soon as reasonably practicable. And we say there's no reason to read that down. Of course, subject to questions about how you give effect to it and what context you're giving effect to it in. The reporting officers are not seeking to reclaim consenting responsibilities for the management of freshwater or Indigenous biological diversity. It is, however, submitted that in answering whether the effects on these matters can be sensibly assessed at a later stage, the panel must consider that question by reference to the MPSFM and One Plan as the relevant framing documents for that assessment.
Just on that point, and then we might have to break for lunch for three quarters of an hour. The MPSFM articulates quite a bicultural perspective on freshwater management, I think it's section 52, subsection 3, contemplates that you will go through a Schedule 1 process. And sometimes you do run the risk, I think, before it has been embedded in a plan, that we are arrogating to ourselves the articulation of a statement of policy that yet hasn't gone through its stage one process. So I think we do, don't you think, have to express some caution that there isn't a Schedule One process yet that articulates those values, and according to the rule of law, we shouldn't be making them in our mind notionally.
Well, I agree with that. The reporting officers are not suggesting that we jump ahead of the Regional Council and consider how the NPS must be applied, but there are some features within the MPSFM which are more clear and do not necessarily require the full-scale Schedule 1 processes to take place, because they do provide some more direct guidance on certain elements that might be relevant to this ultimate question we're asking in this context. Ms. Quinn can speak to them, but one of them is the net loss of stream length, for example, which is directly relevant here because of the, forgive me if I got the figure wrong, 3.9 kilometres of streams that are going to be culverted or piped. So that does tie into the whole consenting idea and the viability of being able to get those consents at a later stage and to mitigate and offset or compensate them within the frame of the requirement we have now.
So yes, and that comes to an interesting point, because the caveat to that principle is functional need. And if we get to the point of approving the designation, we've suddenly given a tremendous tailwind to the functional need argument, because we've created a functional need.
Well,
so I'm not sure there are perfect answers to those points.
No, there's no perfect answer. But on that, just recalling an experience, and Commissioner Palmati and Mackinson might recall some discussion in the Gorge project, and we accepted the proposition in that project that What the panel says here in a requirement process should not legally have any sort of restriction or tailwind over what over the regional council's job. And I suppose we would not expect this decision to provide them a leg up in their regional consenting. And I don't see that as being a necessary consequence of this process.
Well, I agree that we shouldn't go into areas that are not ours, but it does seem to me unreal to suggest that having gone through this process, if the designation is approved, it's a reality that we'll face and have to be assessed as part of an assessment of any regional application. It can't be an irrelevant matter.
Sir, what do you mean, the fact that it has a requirement?
The fact that the requirement has been approved on the basis that the benefits outweigh the effects, and therefore it has, as a land use, some sustainable pedigree.
Yes, yes. Well, yes, I suppose that's true, and I think that's probably a risk that we'd expect that not to happen. But we can't make the notice of requirement not exist.
No.
But
anyway, that's a useful point, and even though I'm finding this very interesting, is this a convenient time to have 3/4 an hour to have lunch and then resume at 2, or...?
Yes, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, we'll come back at 2.